My guest is comedian Steve Hofstetter. He's performing in Eugene on May 3rd at World Pies. Steve is a popular comedian with a long list of accolades in television and movies. He's also written for Sports Illustrated and the NHL. Steve is the founder of Steel City Arts Foundation, which features a communal residency for comedians to live and work on their craft within a supportive community. And Steve may be the only comedian ever nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. We'll ask him what that means. Welcome to The Exchange, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have to start with the Nobel Peace Prize. What's the backstory?
So in 2020, I was doing a lot of philanthropy for the comedy community. Some of it was through my foundation, where we were giving people grants who, you know, couldn't work. I mean, our job was illegal. And also creating a whole bunch of digital work for comedians. We replaced over $1.5 million worth of work for out-of-work comedians. And so one of the fans is a professor at FSU, a guy named Sean Ehrlich, and he decided to nominate me for a Nobel Peace Prize. What a lot of people don't realize is that you can get nominated by a professor in several different disciplines. You don't have to be nominated by the committee. About 200 to 300 people get nominated each year. There's a short list of 20 people who actually become eligible for it. There was no way I was ever going to make the short list. But it's a fun thing as a comedian. When, you know, there was at one point where I was going back and forth online with Marjorie Taylor Greene, and I got a chance to say, I don't know how many Nobel Peace Prize nominees have ever told you to shut up, but it's one more than it used to be.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that story. How long have you been in comedy?
I've been doing stand-up 23 years. I started doing improv before then. I was doing improv when I was a kid. So I guess I've been in comedy one way or another for 32 years.
Wow. What do you remember about your first stage performance?
Oh, my first stand-up set, I more than remembered. I have it on tape. And when I say tape, I mean actual VHS tape. Now, obviously, everybody's filming everything. But back then, I was very lucky in that a friend of mine was dating someone who was an aspiring cinematographer. And she brought a camera, filmed it, and I say I'm lucky because I have it on film. I'm also unlucky because I have it on film. It's terrible. But I actually did decently on my first show. It was my, and then my second show, I was getting a lot of laughs, but then I was getting laughs making fun of not getting laughs. And then on my third show, I thought I was bomb-proof. I even said the words out loud, you know, I guess I can't bomb. Knowing that, you know, I was able to, you know, kind of turn lemons into lemonade on the second show. And the universe heard me and it smote me. And I bombed so hard that I was off stage in under a minute.
Wow. What inspired you?
Imagine how bad it has to be for you to realize 45 seconds in that this can't get better.
Where'd you grow up and what inspired you?
I grew up in Queens, New York. What inspired me? I mean, it depends on inspired for what, you know. I mean, I think that, one of my biggest heroes was Jackie Robinson. My dad was a huge Brooklyn Dodger fan, raised me on stories of, you know, of Jackie Robinson, and we were a mixed family. And so learned a lot, from there. And one of the quotes that really stayed with me is, you know, a life is important in the impact it has on other lives.
Well, you've talked about your father playing comedy albums when you were growing up. Who do you remember listening to?
So the ones that really appealed to me were George Carlin and Dick Gregory. I actually ended up having a chance to tour with Dick Gregory, and I flew my dad out for it, which was, I mean, just such a cool thing to do. I mean, he saw Dick Gregory live when he was 19 years old, before the Civil Rights Act. And the one that I didn't really vibe with was Bill Cosby. And I got to say, I feel pretty vindicated.
So you're the last person that Bill didn't get to.
Yeah, I it's a dark joke, but, you know, I got asked about it on stage once and I say, Cosby always put me to sleep. So I should have seen it coming.
Oh, Lord. Okay. Tell me about your foundation. This was inspired by your dad, right?
Yeah, so my dad was a very generous person. He didn't have money, but he gave his time whenever he could. He was, you know, the person who had volunteered to carpool people to the event. And so I had had this idea of creating a foundation for comedians. At the time, it didn't exist. There were all these charities where comedians were helping other people, whether it was Comic Relief or Laugh for Sight or, you know, a million other things. And there wasn't a single one that focused inward. And so the idea behind the foundation was, you know, comedy makes the world a better place. Let's try to make the world a better place for comedians. And I had been, you know, toying with this idea, and then my dad passed suddenly. And I realized that, you know, time is not promised. And so even though I was not at the point in my career yet where I could create a successful foundation, I sure tried. I sold shirts after shows to try to fund it. And at first it was just, you know, one scholarship for a comedian each year. And it started as $2,000 and it ended up growing to $10,000. And then during the pandemic, you know, as my career is building and I have more reach and the ability to fundraise and the ability to donate more from my own pocket, I turned it into micro grants where it was, you know, 30 different $1,000 grants for comedians to help bridge the gap between not working, not knowing the pandemic would be much longer than they originally had predicted. And from there, you know, created housing and this live, work, play environment. And now we're actually refocusing the foundation back to micro grants because even though it was great to specifically help the community of Pittsburgh, I, you know, I'm a touring comic. I wanted it to be not just, you know, city-based or regional or even national. I want it to be international. And so now, you know, we're creating a situation where where comedians all over the world can submit, whether it is, hey, I got into this prestigious festival, but I can't afford the plane ticket. Or I have a month worth of road work coming up and my car broke. Just, you know, anything that they can do to not have a day job and concentrate on their art.
This might be the only community of comedians in the nation. Am I right?
For the live, work, play one, maybe. You know, but there are other foundations that are helping comedians now. We were the first, but we're thankfully not the only. Stand Up for Stand Up, which is run by the people behind Don't Tell, now does it. And, you know, during the pandemic, I think a lot of people started becoming a little more charity-minded. And so, you know, there's one that has the backing of Comedy Central. There's a couple now, but, you know, we were the first.
My guest is comedian Steve Hofstetter. He's performing in Eugene on May 3rd at World Pies. Steve, in addition to performing live on stage, you produced albums and books and appeared on TV and in movies. What's your favorite?
My favorite is always going to be stand-up. It's also something that I am confident I'm very good at. You know, when, like I did a movie where my largest role in a movie, I was, I think, third lead. And, but there's, you know, there was mainly five of us who were the main cast. And the director asked me how I felt about my performance. And I said, I felt like I was a comedian performing with four actors. Like, they were so good and they knew what they were doing. And I learned so much from them. But, you know, it's not something I have a ton of experience with. And, you know, so stand-up is always going to, that's where my heart is.
In your stand-up routine, I've seen a number of your shows, and you're brilliant. You have a brilliant mind. But you often deal with serious issues from a humorous perspective, like DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is under attack by the Trump administration. What value do you see in DEI?
I see DEI, you know, a lot of people misunderstand it. And, you know, part of that is because of the propaganda around it. DEI is not taking someone from the start line and moving them to the finish line. DEI is allowing everyone to be at the same start line. And if you are someone, you know, the example I gave, and I had a debate with a conservative guy, and the example I gave was, I grew up in New York City, or I had no access to skiing. If you were to put me at the top of a mountain right now and tell me to ski down, I would fall on my face and probably die. So it's not about taking someone and putting them at the end. It's about giving them the tools and the opportunities, especially the opportunities to have equal footing with other people. And that includes professions, that includes education, et cetera. There have been so many studies where, you know, applicants apply blind for a position where they don't know their name, they don't know their gender, they don't know their race, and things are so much more even than when the interviewers know someone is a man or a woman, or the interviewer knows someone is white or black. And so the point of DEI is to just equalize that starting line.
Gotcha. Another big issue that you've addressed in your routine is cultural appropriation.
Yes. I mean, that was one where I addressed that briefly. I mean, the idea is that sometimes we go overboard. You know, I'm on the left, I am a proud progressive, and sometimes we go overboard. We have too small of a tent. And the way I illustrated that point was telling a story where someone asked me, you know, I'm Jewish, and if someone asked me when a non-Jew uses the word kosher, is that, you know, does that bother me? And I couldn't even understand why. I didn't even understand it was that they were trying to say it was cultural appropriation, because, you know, the word culture is French, the word appropriation is Roman. We, at our best, we are a melting pot. And so some things are cultural appropriation, absolutely, and some things are cultural appreciation, and we need to learn the difference.
I like the way you put that. You talk about politics a lot in your comedy, particularly Florida politics. And now Trump, who lived on a golf course in Florida, is president, and Pam Bondi is attorney general, and Marco Rubio is secretary of state. Did Florida just take over the country?
No, no. A couple of fascists did. But the thing that people also don't realize about Florida is that Florida is the best example of a purple state. Now, Ron DeSantis and his cronies have done their best to, you know, cheat it into red. For instance, Florida citizens voted that, you know, people who had felonies in their past should be allowed to vote, which they are allowed in almost every state. And Florida voters, you know, voted, and that's 4 million people in Florida. It's a very highly populated state. And then the, you know, Republicans understand that those votes are often not going to go their way. And so then they put a whole bunch more roadblocks about paying fines and court costs and everything before the vote was restored. There's a lot of cheating in Florida, but that doesn't mean the people there are necessarily regressive. I like to call Florida America's junk drawer. It's where there's a little bit of everything. There's, you know, there might be menus and a packet of soy sauce and the matches and a pair of scissors. It's that drawer in your kitchen. It doesn't have one identity. It has all of them.
Well, Florida gave us Trump, and he's now attacking Medicaid. You have a take on how to fix healthcare, don't you?
I mean, to a degree. Like, one of the things that I'm, you know, very, very assertive about is that I am not an expert. And so I listen to experts. I think that we have, there's this idea of American exceptionalism, but if we're not able to do things that other countries do, is the exceptionalism that we're uniquely dumb? Like, I don't think so. And so if we look at other countries where healthcare is working, you know, if we look at Denmark, or, you know, Trump is so fond of Norway, if we look at countries like that and we go, hey, what's their system? How do we get closer to their system? Because it's not just the insurance companies. It's also the hospitals. You know, we have rules about monopolies when it comes to hospitals. You can't just start up another hospital down the block from one. There has to be their radius clauses. And so when a hospital upcharges by 1,400%, which happens, and then the insurance company goes, oh, well, we can save you 1,300%. Well, then you're still being upcharged 100% of what it actually cost. And that's not okay.
Steve, let's talk a little bit about your career. You were the host of Laughs on Fox, right?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
For the first season.
Tell me about your experience there.
I mean, running a television show, so I was host and executive producer. Running a television show was difficult. There are so many different voices that, you know, you have to appeal to. And I don't mean who's watching the show. I mean, there are people who will be involved in the network who have no concept of what stand-up comedy is, but demand to tell you how it works. You know, there's what you want to do as an artist. I don't think I will ever be involved in a television show again unless I have full creative control.
Well, you're on Comedy All-Stars and Comedy Unleashed. Which did you enjoy most?
Well, I mean, I can appear on shows for sure. I just mean having to produce one. In terms of being on a show, you know, I don't think those are the ones that stand out to me. I think the appearance that I enjoyed the most was when I was on the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. I mean, Ferguson is such a comics comic, and he was wonderful. And there's a great story. I have to censor it because we're on terrestrial radio. But he saw before my set. I was nervous, and I hadn't met him. You know, he just walked over to me in the hallway. He saw, you know, I was kind of pacing a little bit in my own head, and he leaned in, and he didn't say, thank you for being on the show. He didn't say, it's going to be great, don't worry. He didn't tell me what I eventually learned, which is that television crowds are the easiest crowds to do stand-up for because they desperately want you to be funny. But he just leaned in, and he just goes, now don't F up. And it made me laugh, and it just took all the tension away. And it was such a fun time.
Nice. What's been the brightest experience in your career?
It's hard. There have been so many that I've really enjoyed. But I would say probably performing at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. That was a theater that when I lived in Boston, as I was starting to try to become a professional writer and comedian, I would walk by the Wilbur and kind of have that, oh, someday idea. And then someday happened. And it, being able to headline a venue that I kind of grew up idolizing was just incredible.
You feel like you're living your dream?
I am. You know, I have a great career. I have an adorable dog. My wife's super hot. It all adds up, you know? I really enjoy where I am in my life. And so much so that for the first time, I've started thinking about retirement. And I don't intend to anytime soon. But, you know, 15 years or so, maybe. And the reason I'm finally able to start thinking about that is because if I never advanced from where I am right now, I would still be happy. I mean, this is like, for instance, it is great to talk to you and to do this show. But the fact of the matter is the show's already sold out. And so that's not something I used to have. I used to be so desperate to sell tickets and et cetera, et cetera. And now I'm just happy. I'm performing to a full crowd. I'm doing what I love. How can I not enjoy it?
Yeah, just running around the country talking to people who already appreciate you.
That is the hope. But, you know, I'm also trying to affect a positive change as much as possible. I'm using my social media and my act to try to do that. And one thing I really love about being a stand-up comic that a lot of people don't talk about is that I can have a conversation with almost anyone in the world, you know, provided I can speak the same language. I have traveled so much that I have something in common with everyone. You know, for instance, if, you know, look, I don't live in Eugene. I've never lived anywhere near Eugene. But I can talk about the fact that I have a really fun picture of myself next to the duck. And that's great. So that's something I could talk about with someone from Eugene.
My guest is comedian Steve Hofstetter. He's performing in Eugene on May 3rd at World Pies. So, Steve, in your stage performances, you often play off the audience members. I'm curious, how did you learn to handle impromptu conversations and sometimes hecklers so well?
Well, I'm the youngest of four. I mean, you know, I grew up having to think off the cuff. The reality is my brother and one of my sisters and I, our love language was roasting each other. And that's just, you know, it was survival of the fittest and survival of the quickest. And so I think that sharpens you. Also, I'm the youngest, which meant I had to keep up with people who were older, more mature, more educated, had more experiences than I did. And my brother's a phenomenal writer. And he was, you know, always ahead of me. And he also skipped a grade. So he is basically 5 years ahead of me. And so he would judge my writing according to his age. And so when he was 15 and I'm, you know, and I'm 11, but he's, you know, in class with 16-year-olds, I'm trying to write to his level. Now, was I writing to his level? Probably not. But because of him, I was writing 2-3 years ahead of mine.
So what goes through your head when you sense that someone is seeking a moment with you as an antagonist?
Usually I try to, you know, I try to stop the moment first. There's a lot of times where I'll hear a little something and I'll say a quick, I don't know what you just tried to say, but I'm sure it was stupid, and I'll just move on. But if it is someone who is genuinely trying to interrupt the show, now, I have never once posted a clip of someone who was trying to get on my social media. That's only happened twice. Both times I deleted the footage because I didn't even want to be tempted. But if someone is trying to, you know, be the show from the audience, the main reason I'm putting my foot down is not because I'm insulted and, you know, my ego is bruised that they're trying to usurp me. No, it's because I need control of the room. And hundreds of people bought tickets to see a show. They didn't buy tickets to see some drunk loudmouth yelling out. So it is a combination of maintaining control and, you know, giving the people what they want.
Well, you often share the stage with other comedians in your videos, which have attracted millions of views on YouTube. How did that element of collective engagement with fellow comedians become a signature part of your career?
So I invite the other comedians on the show up with me for the Q&A, which is the end of the show. And that started out of necessity. It was, so I had, you know, a dog that I loved very, very much. And he was very sick. I knew I'd have to put him down in a few days. And it was just kind of, it was the end. And my fans knew about my dog. I talked about him a lot. And so he often came up in the Q&A. And I was traveling with two very close friends. And I said to them, I can't do the Q&A myself. If they bring up Walter, I will not be able to handle it. Can you join me on stage and kind of protect me from this? And they said, sure. And we did those two shows. And I found that bouncing off each other was so much fun. And so it was something I tried a couple more times. And then I was touring with Daniel Muggleton, who's an Australian comic. And it is wild how much onstage chemistry we have during a Q&A. It's as much as I like doing the Q&A with my other comedy friends, there's nothing like doing it with Dan. And so that the success of that and the fun of that made me realize, like, oh, this is something that should be a staple of the show. And for the comedians who tour with me, it's the thing they look forward to most about the shows.
Well, you produced a number of comedy albums and even hit number one on the iTunes comedy chart. Which album was that?
So the album that hit number one, I believe, was... I don't even remember anymore. That's a good sign, right? That's either a sign my career is going well or I'm getting old. But I think the one that hit number one was Dark Side of the Room, which, you know, was my favorite for a while. You know, I like my new specials more now. But, you know, it was in a time where charts still really mattered for albums. And I was very proud of, you know, being, you know, this unheralded comedian on the same chart with some really big names.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Good luck in Eugene.
Well, thank you so much. And I appreciate you having me on the show.
Thank you, Steve.